Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions, with support from the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Appalachian Impact Fund, working together to promote community collaboration, economic development, and education by increasing charitable giving and philanthropic investments across communities in southeastern Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us.
You can't erase it. You can't erase it. That is.
More than 60 people gathered to protest in front of a Confederate monument on Callaway County Courthouse grounds recently after the county fiscal court unanimously approved a resolution keeping the monument there. Regina Hudspeth, 61, African-American, has lived in Murray her entire life.
You hear the argument of it's been here all this long and nobody's ever really, you know, complained about it. Yes, but why complain when you're just a handful of people and you don't have a majority of people behind you? Now we have that.
Hudspeth says the unanimous resolution is appalling to her, but she's protesting to send a message that removal advocates aren't dropping the issue. It's a recurring debate as America experiences racial and civil unrest. Does the removal or relocation of monuments honoring the Confederacy erase or correct history? For some perspective on how these statues got there in the first place, we turn to a pair of historians who have devoted much of their lives to the study of the Civil War and, in particular, the appearance of memorials to the Confederacy in places of prominence in the cities and towns of Kentucky. First, Penn State historian Joy Jaguer, author of Flaunting the Evidence of Treason in the Face of Loyalty, Funerals, Grave Decoration, and the Fashioning of Kentucky's Civil War Identity. The paper has been published by the Filson Historical Society and Cincinnati Museum Center. Dr. Jaguer is a member of the Register of the Kentucky Historical Society Editorial Advisory Board, and she is a Register author. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Jaguer.
I'm happy to be here.
And if we could, let's just begin with a brief reminder of Kentucky's posture during the Civil War, because I think a lot of people are unclear about that.
Absolutely. I think Kentucky is really one of the more fascinating states to look at during the Civil War era, simply because it was such a conflicted place. At the beginning of the war, Kentucky attempted, or rather its political leaders attempted, to maintain neutrality, but that did not last very long. Basically, do not pick a side, neither the Union nor the Confederacy. But ultimately, there was pressure for Kentucky to go one way or the other. And in the end, by the fall of 1861, Kentucky's leadership, which was mainly led by conservative unionists, they decided to go the way of the Union rather than the Confederacy, which was rather surprising to Confederate leadership, so much so that Confederates had actually reserved a star on the flag for the state of Kentucky because they expected their sister slave state to join them. But the position of conservative unionists was that really better the devil you know than the devil that you don't. The Constitution already had provisions for the protection of the institution of slavery. Abraham Lincoln had been very clear in his rhetoric that he did not want to abolish slavery where it already existed. And they were very much for also preserving the Union, hence conservative unionists. They were both pro-slavery and pro-Union. So that's the direction that Kentucky goes in. But that kind of obscures how conflicted the general population was. So somewhere between 90 and 100,000 Kentuckians served in the Union Army. A sizable chunk of them were members of the USCT, the United States Colored Troops. And then about 25 to 40,000 served officially in the Confederate Army. But we also see numbers that we can't really quantify of guerrillas and bushwhackers who were pro-secessionist, pro-Confederate. And then you also have a very divided civilian population, many of whom were pro-Union, many of whom were pro-secession. So this is a state that is just internally very divided throughout the course of the war.
The Emancipation Proclamation of 1863 declares that all persons held as slaves within the rebellious states are and henceforward shall be free. Was this a great moral moment, or was it something else? Was it a military strategy?
The Emancipation Proclamation, I think for a lot of people, we look back at it as this great moral moment, and through it, we have fashioned our popular image of Lincoln the Emancipator. And while it does have a moral outcome, the proclamation was very much part of Lincoln's overall military strategy to win the war. It was very strategic in its language, stating that only slaves in rebellion territory would be forever free. This means that slaves who were held in bondage in the border slave states that remained loyal to the Union, including Kentucky, Missouri, Maryland, and Delaware, those slave owners got to keep their slave property. And the reason for this is because Lincoln very much did not want to rock the boat and alienate conservative unionists in those border South slave states. One of the things that he said during the war was, "I'd like to have God on my side, but I must have Kentucky." So we can get a sense for how much the Emancipation Proclamation was very strategically oriented to only apply to liberating enslaved African Americans in Confederate states. It was a means to strip the labor force of the South and weaken the Southern economy so that that could help to secure a Union victory. For many Kentucky slave owners, even though they were made promises that their slave property would not be liberated, they saw the writing on the wall with the Emancipation Proclamation. And there were those in Western Kentucky who just peremptorily emancipated their slaves in the middle of the war. There were others that felt incredibly abandoned by the federal government. They felt betrayed, as though they had remained loyal in good faith. But again, they saw the writing on the wall that with the Emancipation Proclamation, it was just another hop, skip, and a jump away from the 13th Amendment, which would completely abolish slavery around the country. And this is where we see a lot of anger directed towards the federal government during the post-war period, that sense of disillusionment with the aims of conservative unionism, and what helped turn the tide in Kentucky towards a greater Confederate identity post-war, and hence why we see ultimately end up seeing so many Confederate monuments in the state of Kentucky.
The secessionists' reason for leaving the Union was made very clear, maybe too clear for the comfort of some, by Confederate Vice President Alexander H. Stephens in his cornerstone speech in Savannah in March of 1861, when he said, quote, "White democracy rests upon the cornerstone of slavery. Slavery is the natural and normal condition of Africans," end quote. Should Stephens' words settle the argument over why the South seceded?
I don't see why it wouldn't. And when you look at the primary documents associated with secession, and when I say primary documents, this is a historical term referring to the documents and materials that were created during the time period that we're looking at. So his speech, the state secession resolutions, these are all primary documents in which white Southerners are very explicitly telling us exactly why they're leaving the Union. And they are very clear about the fact that the right to own human property, the protection of the institution of slavery, this is why they seceded from the Union. Now, once secession was completed, the white Confederate leadership had to work on rearranging the rhetoric in order to get the 75% of non-slaveholding whites across the South on board with fighting a war for the Confederacy. And this is where we see the emergence of language about states' rights and fighting against an oppressive, distant federal government. But you can't get any clearer than Stephens' cornerstone speech. And it actually made things a bit difficult for Confederate leadership who, through diplomacy, were trying to get aid from foreign powers in Europe, many of whom, you know, England and France in particular, they did not want to provide aid to the Confederacy if they were fighting explicitly for the right to own slaves. And so there was a lot of, you know, backpedaling and diplomatic maneuvering that had to be done, because Alexander Stephens, he committed a cardinal sin in politics. He told the truth.
Well, you write that Kentucky Confederates established, and this phrase is wonderful, a visual rhetoric on the cultural landscape that has endured to this day. And we're talking about the statues and the memorials to Confederate notables, people like Jefferson Davis, John Hunt Morgan. Who put up these statues? Why did they put them up?
So in Kentucky, we see a little bit of a difference immediately post-war compared to the ex-Confederate states. In the former Confederate states, as soon as the war was over, local women gathered together to create what were called Ladies' Memorial Associations, or LMAs. And they really functioned as the precursor to the United Daughters of the Confederacy, which really became the powerhouse of Confederate memorialization efforts beginning in the 1890s and into the 20th century. In Kentucky, we don't see quite so many LMAs being established. And so it was more unofficial groups of local ladies coming together to decorate graves and to raise funds for the erection of permanent monuments and memorials. And then eventually by the 1890s, as the national organization of the UDC got up and running, we see local chapters of the UDC functioning within the state of Kentucky as well. And throughout the late 19th and into the 20th centuries, Southern white women really dominated commemorative efforts and in shaping the narrative of the public history and public memory of the war. They were really instrumental in the fundraising efforts, but they, along with Confederate veterans as well, worked hand in hand to create a public narrative of this is why we fought the war, this is how we conceive of ourselves and the side of the South during the course of the war. And what's interesting in creating this cultural rhetoric of the war is that it completely obscures slavery as the cause of secession. And it focuses entirely on the valor and heroism and self-sacrifice of white Confederate soldiers. And there's also a sense of triumphalism in Confederate monuments that while they accepted military defeat, they articulate a message of the triumph of the ideology of the lost cause, that Southerners fought for all the right reasons and that their values ultimately prevailed and would persist into the future in perpetuity.
You begin a 2019 article in the Public Historian with an account of the removal of the 70-foot-tall Confederate Soldiers Monument that had been sitting on 3rd Street in Louisville for 121 years. And there have been successful efforts to relocate many of these statues, including the likeness of Jefferson Davis. And some say the removal of these monuments is a slippery slope, and they wonder, where is this going? Where does it end? Is there an answer to that question?
I've seen the slippery slope argument come up many times on social media, and I get asked this question quite a bit. And my response to that is that it does not have to be a slippery slope. What I'm witnessing right now, especially with protesters and groups that are articulating both through words and actions and in tearing down monuments, they're venting this pent-up frustration with our longstanding acceptance of an overtly white supremacist narrative of the Civil War by maintaining Confederate monuments on the physical landscape. And we do, as a society, need to reckon with what these monuments mean on the landscape and what do they say about our values in the 21st century. Because the monuments are not themselves history. They are a form of propaganda. They are the stories that we tell ourselves about who we are and what we value as a people. And so in considering the place of monuments on the American cultural landscape, communities need to think about what is the monument? Who is the monument for? And what is that person or group of people known for? What do they fight for? What do they value? And so there are many people who are talking about, well, it's the Confederate monuments today, and tomorrow it's going to be the monuments to the founding fathers. And to that I say, you know, many of the founding fathers, they are certainly problematic because all people are problematic. We're multidimensional, and we have many faults. But the difference between monuments to the founding fathers and monuments to the Confederates is that the founding fathers did not fight for the creation of a society that rested upon the cornerstone of slavery. Confederates did. And so each monument, I think, needs to be assessed by its community so that there can be a sense of consensus about, does this monument reflect our values? No, then we take it down. If it still reflects our highest ideals and our best values about who we conceive of ourselves as a people, then keep it up. But I think it needs to be a community-based discussion and decision, because in many cases, it was local communities that put these monuments up in the first place.
Joy Jaguer is Associate Professor of History at Penn State York. Dr. Jaguer is a member of the Register of the Kentucky Historical Society Editorial Advisory Board, and she is a Register author. Thanks, Joy.
Thank you very much for having me.
And by the way, that's an interesting name, Jaguer. What does that mean?
It's French-Canadian. It means a girl who dances a jig.
Ann Marshall has documented the history of the appearance of Confederate monuments on the courthouse lawns and town squares of many communities across Kentucky. Her book, Creating a Confederate Kentucky, was published in 2013, and it's since become a widely referenced resource on the efforts of partisans of the Lost Cause to establish that visual rhetoric on the cultural landscape that Joy Jaguer talked about in the previous interview. Ann teaches courses in history at Mississippi State University. She joins us from a cottage in the north where she has gone with her family to escape the summer heat of their home in Mississippi. Greetings, Ann.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
And if you would set the scene for us, it's post-Civil War and Confederate monuments are beginning to appear in cities and towns across Kentucky. And at the same time, very few monuments are erected by Union partisans. What's going on? What's happening in this period?
So, in the 30 years or so after the Civil War, white Kentuckians built Civil War monuments here and there throughout the state, usually in cemeteries. And what is interesting is that, like you mentioned, many of them were erected to honor the Confederacy, many more than for the Union, which of course is notable because Kentucky was indeed a Union state during the Civil War. Far more men, an estimated 90 to 100,000 Kentucky men, fought for the Union, while historians estimate that only about 30 to 40,000 men fought for the Confederacy. So this lopsided representation for the Confederacy is really notable. And after 1895, so about 30 years after the war, and through World War I, there was a huge surge in monument construction for the Confederacy. So about 27 Confederate monuments were erected in Kentucky between 1895 and 1925, while the Union monuments during this time, there were only about three of them. So really lopsided representation there.
These are just big bronze likenesses of men, almost all exclusively men, and I'm wondering, how do they influence life in Kentucky?
Yes, well, I think that more than influencing life, they really reflected what was going on in terms of not just how Kentuckians were remembering the war and that they had sort of adopted this Confederate narrative. They really were sort of really kind of buying into this Lost Cause narrative that the United Daughters of the Confederacy was promoting, and the UDC during this time was really responsible for this later surge of monument construction. But they not only were reflecting that, but they were reflecting larger measures that were taking place in Kentucky to assure white supremacy during this time period. So the state government began to pass Jim Crow laws in the 1890s that segregated transportation and public spaces and schools. And also this is the really sort of the heyday of the lynching of African Americans after the Civil War. Hundreds of African Americans were lynched in Kentucky during the same time period. So the message of white supremacy in statute form coincided and reinforced these laws and practices that were going on in the state.
Did the presence of these monuments and these statues deliver a less than subtle message? Did anyone express concern about how African-American Kentuckians might be interpreting the presence of these monuments?
You don't see a whole lot of protest coming from the African-American community itself, but I think it was certainly implied. Whites would have understood that African-Americans would see these as a larger reflection of white supremacy that was being codified in Jim Crow laws and in other forms of racial oppression. But certainly having a monument on a courthouse lawn where if you were African American, you knew you could not get a fair trial, or in a town square where you could not serve in the government, was certainly not lost on African Americans.
There is a monument honoring African American soldiers in the Frankfort Cemetery, and I wonder why is it important to note that this monument resides in a cemetery and not in a prominent spot in a city or town, as you just mentioned?
Yes. Well, the monument you speak of is in the Green Hill Cemetery in Frankfort, so not the larger one that we associate with Daniel Boone's grave. And it was placed there in 1924 by an African-American chapter of the Women's Relief Corps of the Grand Army of the Republic, which was the sort of unionist equivalent to the United Daughters of the Confederacy. And it was erected to honor African-American soldiers from Central Kentucky who had served as U.S. colored troops during the war. Almost 24,000 Black Kentuckians fought for the Union during the war. And it was a very simple obelisk, and like it was sort of more ornate, soldiers that you see in other Civil War monuments during this time. And the fact that it's in a cemetery is important because it really reflects the fact that African Americans didn't have access to public space to tell their Civil War stories. So today, most people would drive right past this small cemetery and never know that this monument is there. And I think it's important that we remember today that the reason why this Confederate memory is so visible today is that it's really a reflection of who had the power when these monuments were built.
Well, what else besides monuments were the United Daughters of the Confederacy up to in those times?
Yes, well, the monument building campaigns were really just one part of the Daughters' larger aim to represent the history of the Confederacy and more broadly the history of the South before the Civil War. And they focused a lot of effort on educating children, future generations, as they saw it. So in Kentucky, they sponsored essay contests on topics like the meaning of secession and defining states' rights. They produced supplements to textbooks that were used in Kentucky public schools to make sure that students got what they thought of as, an impartial history of the Civil War, that it was taught as sort of, that states' rights was the cause rather than slavery. One of the most unique things that the UDC did in Kentucky was to usher through the passage of a statute called the Uncle Tom's Cabin Law in 1906. This was so-called because it started with their efforts to prevent the showing of a very popular play that was based on Harriet Beecher Stowe's famous book. They didn't want it being presented in Kentucky, and the idea was that this play portrayed their slaveholding ancestors in a really bad light. So they claimed that it would incite African Americans to resentment, maybe even to mob action. And so they got this law passed that censored any kind of public performance of history that they didn't like. And so I think it's a really interesting example. It's a very clear example of how they linked the portrayal of the past to the politics of the present in Kentucky.
Speaking of the present, there's a lot of very sensitive debate going on all around the country right now over the removal of monuments celebrating the Confederacy. Among those opposed are those who say that this is an act of rewriting or revising history. Is that the case, or is it more accurate to say that these removals revise the original revision of history?
Yes. Well, I share the opinion of a lot of historians today that it's not revising history, but rather it's removing a very particular portrayal of history that's not just a painful reminder of the past for African Americans, but rather really a reflection of their current racial oppression. And I think the link between the two is not something that is being pointed out by the people who, not just people who are oppressed, not just African-Americans, but by the people who are actually celebrating their role as oppressors. So we see this, saw this very clearly with the connection between Confederate symbolism and Dylann Roof in Charleston in 2015, and the Unite the Right white supremacists who carried Confederate flags and were protecting the Robert E. Lee statue in Charlottesville in 2017. So I think white supremacists have made very clear the connection between this Confederate symbolism and their goals today. So, I think it is an interesting case in Kentucky, though, because removing the statues might help remind people that Kentucky was a Union state rather than a Confederate state during the war.
Have you ever wondered, Ann, what sort of difference it would have made in our society had those monuments never appeared on our courthouse lawns and in our town squares?
Well, I've never actually asked myself that particular question, but I do think that since the monuments are really a symptom of a larger racial power differential in our country today, we'd still be where we are if we didn't have them around. But I do often say that if white Americans had actually followed through on all of the promises laid out in the 14th and 15th Amendments, the promises of full citizenship and political and civic equality, I doubt very much that these monuments would be under such fire today. I think they might be actually viewed as sort of benign relics of the past rather than, controversial political symbols.
Ann Marshall is author of Creating a Confederate Kentucky, and we thank you so much for taking time for us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Coming up after the break.
At 9 o'clock, I would just leave my phone in my kitchen plugged up, and I would go to bed, and I would quit answering those calls and start back at 8 o'clock the next morning.
Teaching our kids by remote in a pandemic. Continuing our series of conversations with Kentucky school teachers. And
that's sort of the essence of our mission, is for Green Room Exchange, to get people in the bluegrass the opportunity to see countries through the eyes of those that live there. Because, of course, music and art is a universal language.
A Lexington couple's mission to bring world music and culture to the bluegrass. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Support for WEKU and Eastern Standard comes from Hicks & Funson. Kentucky lawyers Greg Funson, Kenny Heumann, Kayla Combs, and Shannon Church provide legal representation for auto accidents, medical malpractice, elder care, and immigration law. More information at 859-777-7000.
Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or past episodes? Find them online at weku.org or on the WEKU mobile app. Do you have a news tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-522-WEKU. It might be featured on a future show. Now, back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
Recently published polling by Axios and Ipsos found that about 7 in 10 Americans view sending their children back to school as a large or moderate risk, and this includes 82% of Democrats, 53% of Republicans. Educators and teachers' unions have raised significant concerns about the safety of returning to classrooms. Although children face relatively low risks from the virus, older teachers and parents face higher risks of having a serious or even fatal infection. Cynthia Reeser continues our ongoing series of conversations with teachers about the challenges of reopening schools.
So we're here today with Rhonda Gross, and Rhonda teaches at Hayes Lewis Elementary School in Leslie County Public School System. And she teaches fourth grade math, and then she teaches social studies to fifth, sixth, seventh, and eighth graders. So Rhonda, we know schools closed Friday, March 13th, and in some districts, schools were able to provide schoolwork for students online. But how did your school provide work for your students with the challenges faced with lack of internet or computer devices at home during these non-traditional instructional days or these NTI days?
Well, we did this a couple different ways. The first thing we did was we did a survey to see how many kids had internet access. And, of course, we had several kids that did not. And we provided online on Google Classroom. We posted those there. We also printed paper packets for those students that didn't have internet, or maybe some of them would say, well, my internet's slow, Ms. Gross, so I'd rather have a paper copy instead. And then, you know, we had that extended time. We only were suspecting, what is it, 2 weeks at the beginning. And some of the kids, we dropped those paper packets off once they finished. Some of them dropped those off when they finished at school. Sometimes some of the kids had theirs dropped off by the bus. We sent out paper copies for anybody that asked for one before they left school.
And your buses would run their routes with meals, school supplies, and with the schoolwork, right?
They would. So any of the kids that wanted to, they could go get meals a couple different ways. We had 3 days that they provided meals, and the kids could meet the bus at certain spots in the county, or they could just stop at the school and toot their horn and pick it. The kitchen would bring it out to them that way. Sometimes if they needed those paper packets, they would provide those at that time.
So a teacher's work day, we can visualize what it would be like in a regular school year, but your work day changed dramatically after March 13th. So tell about how you communicated with your students and sort of your work hours during this time.
Well, this is the craziest work hours I believe I ever had. I would, on a typical day, would start contacting my kids by, you know, I'd start at 8 o'clock in the morning like I normally would. Because our district told us, you know, you need to keep your kids on a schedule. So my kids and myself, we just stayed on schedule. So I get up and start contacting kids, and my kids would get up and start doing their NTI packets.
Your own children?
Yes, ma'am, my own kids. What I would do is, and we were all of our schools were told to contact their homeroom classes, and we had to do that once a week. I counted them. I had 79 kids. Different students in all of my classes. So any time that one of my kids was a day behind on their work, I would contact them because I know these kids. I've had them for, you know, all year, or some of them I've had since the fourth grade. So I know those kids pretty good, and I would call them and contact them. Sometimes I would just send their parents a text if they didn't have phone, or basically call. We had a choice to where we could, you know, contact them. Some of my kids contacted me by Facebook Messenger and would send and be like, Ms. Gross, how do I do this problem? And that sort of thing. So it was just according to the particular student. I didn't tell you, though, but I would start at 8 o'clock, and then I would quit answering. I had to eventually quit answering calls by 9 o'clock at night. At some point, I contacted my principal, and I said, I'm getting calls, you know, contacts all through the night. So at 9 o'clock, I would just leave my phone in my kitchen plugged up, and I would go to bed, and I would quit answering those calls and start back at 8 o'clock the next morning. I think the latest contact I got was like 3 o'clock in the morning from a student asking for help.
Wow.
Yeah.
To make problems even tougher, in mid-April, there was a storm that caused some widespread power outages in your area, and I think there were some people in Leslie County that were without power and landline phone service for up to 2 weeks. So you already had some challenges here communicating with your students in lots of different ways, telephone, text, internet, Facebook. So how did that storm make problems even tougher?
Well, that Easter storm, we actually lost our power for a whole week, for 7 days, and I lost my telephone line for 19 days. So what we did was, so that I could contact as many kids as I could, is we ran our generator for so many hours a day, and I would contact my kids using my Wi-Fi calling. When the generator was running, my Wi-Fi box was plugged up so it would work. So I didn't have phone to contact those kids, and I still wanted to contact as many as I could. So I used the generator to call my kids in Wi-Fi calling to try to keep up with them. And it very, very crazy, but, I mean, it worked because that's all we had.
And I think you had some students that just failed to stop checking in after the storm, didn't you?
Yes, ma'am. We had students that they didn't have generators. Like, well, you know, we're blessed to have one. I had several students that didn't have power, and they didn't have, you know, we live in a rural area. There's hardly any signal at all. You might get one bar if you're lucky, but there was no way to contact them. So I did lose contact with a couple of my students because of that. And then our principal, she did a whole lot of home visits trying to contact those students that we did lose contact with.
You also shared a story with me about some students that made an extra effort to do their work.
Oh, yes, ma'am. Oh, I had two specific students in my class that they, just as we were, they did not have internet and the power had went out. And so they drove up on top of the strip mine and they used a cell phone service to do their NTI day work for, I know specifically for my class. I'm positive they probably did the rest of their work up there too. But there wasn't a day that went by that those two students did not have their work turned in to me every day. And that's how they did it. Their parents contacted me. They're like, we went up to the strip mines and let the kids do their work.
Wow.
Yeah, it's amazing and how much work ethic those kids had.
And, you know, teachers do more than just teach academic subjects. You know, you see your students every day. And when you see them, you can really monitor not just their academic achievement, but their health and their safety. And you can take action if needed. So tell about how you worried about, you know, your worries about your students.
Well, I'm definitely worried about our kids. One of the main things I was worried about is some of these kids that I had lost contact with, I worried about them having access to food in general. I mean, I know that their education is really important, and I know that they needed to do NTI work, but I was really concerned about just their basic needs and lack of contact with them. And I started doing some of the programs that they suggested, like Flipgrid, so that I could see some of my kids and see, you know, just doing a little video just to see if they're okay, and just so I could see them in a little live video sort of made me feel better about some of them. But I had a lot of kids that did not have access to be able to do that. It's a lot of stress on a teacher that really cares about her students.
Yeah, and Flipgrid is a video. It's an app, and you can put it on your telephone, and you can record little videos, and students can sort of talk through their lesson on a video, right?
Yes, I post about one or two a week for the kids that had access. That way, the district wanted us to be able to see their see the kids and make sure that they're okay, and that was one of the safer ways that I figured that I could do that, which wasn't too hard on the kids. And they would be able to, I would be able to see if they were okay or not.
So looking ahead, we're not sure what's going to happen in August. What do you worry about the most?
Well, one of the biggest things is you know, I know that NTI, it's set up and it's not a traditional classroom. I worry about our kids' education, like how much they're retaining and how much that they may potentially lose over this long period without, you know, instruction. I'm sort of worried about how we're going to do it safely without, you know, having more kids sick and that sort of thing. And, you know, if we go to school, how are we going to do that? And we don't have any kind of details on what exactly that it's going to be like. I know that our district has touched base with us, asking us, you know, how we feel about going back. But I don't think anything is written in stone right now.
And teachers spend a lot of time, a lot of summers, preparing for the next year, and it's hard to know what to prepare for, isn't it?
Yes, we're trying to figure, I don't even know what I'm teaching yet, so right now, because we're such a small school, sometimes, you know, I might not be teaching math to the fourth grade next year. I might be teaching reading to the fourth grade. It's sort of a really all up in the air right now, and it is so unsure. We're unsure about everything right now, so not knowing is a little scary, I would think.
I agree. Well, enjoy the rest of your summer as much as you can, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
For Kentucky schools, the spring was a massive experiment in remote learning. But the information collected by the state doesn't answer the question of how many students were doing schoolwork every day or doing any work at all. More from Graham Ambrose with the Kentucky Center for Investigative Reporting.
State data would suggest that remote learning during the coronavirus pandemic this spring went better than expected. Around 90% of Kentucky students participated in non-traditional instruction, or NTI, the state's at-home replacement for in-person school. But what counted as participation differed widely across districts, schools, and sometimes even from teacher to teacher. David Cook is the Director of Innovation for the Kentucky Department of Education. He says the looser standard for participation is necessary.
The teachers knowing where their kids were was just as valuable as all of that academic stuff.
In some places, a student was marked as participating for turning in work. Other times, it meant a student or their parent had simply talked with or texted a teacher. Some teachers said 95% or more of their students participated, according to their district's definition. But that doesn't mean anywhere close to 95% of students were doing all or even most of the work.
If it were a paper packet, they were going through just marking things.
That's Lorraine Lettingham, a 64-year-old teacher in Bath County.
You could tell when you looked at it that they hadn't read the information, they hadn't done the work in any kind of quality.
Lettingham has chronic lung issues, including a rare form of asthma. During NTI, she would wake up at 3 a.m. in order to photocopy homework packets before early morning pickup. Now, with the fall unclear, the continued health risk from the coronavirus means she's considering a premature retirement. For the Kentucky Center for Investigative Reporting, I'm Graham Ambrose.
For years now, the Lexington nonprofit Green Room Exchange has hosted Celebrate the Creative, an annual fundraising event in support of the efforts of its founders to bring international artists to perform and record in Lexington and to share their cultures. And like everything else, this event, where social distancing would not work and masking would make it hard to have a conversation, this event is going virtual for 2020. And here to give us the details of that are Green Room Exchange founders, Lee Carroll and Connie Milligan. Hello, Lee and Connie.
Hey, guys.
Hi.
So whichever one of you wants to begin this, tell us what's planned for this year's Celebrate the Creative event.
Yeah, Tom, it's going to feature music and dance from some of the artists we've worked with in the past, including Ziamora Laugert from Cuba, Aliyoune Gassé and Numakunda Sissoko from Senegal, Godwin Abatsi from Ghana, and locally, Trip Bratton will do some drum stuff for us, and Teresa Toom will dance. So those things will be online for our fundraiser.
That's the music portion of the event. Like, we always like to make it a party. So we want to have music, so we thought highlighting the musicians we've worked with by having them record some things and hosting that online will be a feature that people can enjoy. But the part of our Celebrate the Creative is our auction of creative experiences. You know, since our mission is to give people the experience of the arts and music of other culture, what we like to do with our auction is to auction off experiences. So we're offering a wide range of different kinds of things, such as lessons in art, Ikebana flower arranging, guitar lessons, djembe drumming, belly dancing and yoga lessons, along with some other artistic expressions such as massage, architectural design consultation, and studio visits to see people working like at Dwayne Lundy's recording studio. And we hope to give people a bird's eye view of what you do on Eastern Standard too, Tom.
Absolutely. We're up for that.
Good.
To give people an idea of the background of this, you two have traveled extensively, Italy, Ghana, Cuba, Mexico, Amsterdam, Portugal, Belgium, and always with a plan to try to connect with the local artistic community and, when possible, find ways to bring it back home to Lexington. And so you traveled for this project just as we were in the early stages of what would become this pandemic. Briefly, where did you go and what was the goal?
Well, Connie and I went to Senegal in March with our friend Alioune Gassay, primarily to start a recording project with Senegalese artists, he and Numakunda Sissoko. They have a studio in Dakar. It was really, really an interesting experience. When we travel, we like to travel with folks who are from that country, and it opens up things in a way that just being a tourist doesn't. Problem is, we halfway through our visit, the pandemic hit. Numbers in Kentucky were very low when we left, but within a week of being in Senegal, things started to skyrocket. It became apparent we were going to have some problems. So Connie had a flight early to come home, and she got on her plane. The next day, they came out and announced that if you didn't get on a plane and come home, you weren't going to get back to the U.S. So
they had shut the airport down overnight. I had the last flight out.
Wow.
Yeah. So I started to scramble with Alioune, who has a U.S. passport. We both wanted to get back to the States, and we were lucky enough at the last minute to get on an embassy flight, the last plane out of Dakar. So we got home. The problem was we left Senegal 10 days early. So we were just getting rolling on our recording project when we had to leave town.
I'd say there might be a song in that, Last Plane Out of Dakar.
Yeah.
So you started a recording project there that you're completing here. Is that right?
Well, we're working on it here with the material that I brought back. We'd like to bring Numakunda and Alioune to Lexington at some point, but I would also like to return to Dakar and record with those musicians. There's such a vibrant music scene in Senegal. We spent quite a bit of time in the studio, and the whole time we were there, musicians were in and out playing all sorts of music. It's a very exciting place to be.
I know that you have an online recording project underway, a music video. Can you tell us more about that?
Yes. We call this No Boundaries. Dealing with the difficulties of, there are no live performances during the pandemic. I mean, you really can't get out and do that. So working within those limitations, we're going to work with some of the musicians we worked with in the past remotely and some local musicians to put together a project. It will be composed collectively, performed and filmed in each person's location, and then edited here at Dwayne Lundy's Lexington Recording Company. And a videographer who's worked with Green Room, John Buckman, will edit the video. At that point, we'll also make that video available to local nonprofits who have an interest in this sort of thing, Lexington Community Radio and LexArts and other places that might have an interest in it.
Yeah, this was our answer to, since we can't do any live performances this year, we've had to figure out some other ways to create this new forms of expression to maintain our mission to bring this interesting cultural exchange to our Lexington audience. So we're excited about doing the No Boundaries project.
And what is the date of Celebrate the Creative?
August 15th and 16th. It'll run over the course of a weekend. And we'll host it on our Facebook page and on our website, which is greenroomexchange.org.
Looking ahead and crossing our fingers that this can happen, what can we look forward to for 2021?
We've reserved 6 dates next year, one every 2 months at Pam Miller Downtown Arts Center to put on shows. We want to bring back some familiar artists, Ziamora Laugard and Alioune, and some artists that haven't performed here. Domenica Fassati, who dances with Gideon's group when he tours in town, she has a really great Afrobeat band out of Brooklyn, and we want to bring them in. And actually, we're sitting on some tickets to Columbia right now. We had planned to go to Columbia and locate some other artists, but we're not sure if that's going to happen or not with the way things are going. But if all goes well, and we're able to do the performances next year, we're planning on 6 performances at the Pam Miller Downtown Arts Center.
Okay, and we just have a little bit of time left, but I wanted to be sure to leave enough time to squeeze this in, because when you told me about it, it was pretty remarkable. I didn't get to experience it, and I would now wish I had, but I think our listeners would be really interested in what you saw happen at last year's Roots and Heritage Festival when Green Room Exchange guest artist arrived and performed.
It was such a wonderful experience. One, Numacundo and Aliou Gassay from Senegal had never been to this part of the country before. They'd been to New York, but they felt so welcomed and embraced by the hospitality of all of our friends and neighbors and at the festival itself. I mean, they were recognized, Aliou in particular was recognized as a star in his country by many of the vendors. And so people were coming out and kind of rushing up to them and wanting, you know, autographs and just so excited to see them. It was an outpouring of love for everyone involved. And this has been kind of the experience we've had with everyone we've brought here. People feel very welcomed and at home here. As Aliou said, he feels more at home here in the United States than he does anywhere else. So I think what we have here is very special. We are a very welcoming community.
Let's take a moment and just listen to part of that performance. And that's pretty important to underscore, isn't it, at this moment about how this connects cultures through music, which is important in these very fraught times we're in.
Yeah, exactly. And that's sort of the essence of our mission is for Green Room Exchange to get people in the bluegrass the opportunity to see countries through the eyes of those that live there. Because, of course, music and art is a universal language. We're helping people discover that we really are more alike than different. And now our artistic guests also get a chance to experience what open-hearted hospitality the bluegrass has to offer. So it's a win for everyone involved.
Okay. Lee Carroll, Connie Milligan, co-founders of Green Room Exchange in Lexington. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tom.
That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, an accredited community foundation, and their Appalachian Impact Fund. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our producing engineer and audio editor. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard online at weku.org or esweku.org, on the WEKU mobile app, or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. We do like to hear from you. You can email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.